Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. I'm just a host, standing in front of you listeners, asking you to listen to my podcast. And hey, listen, call me crazy or misguided or just downright stalkery, but how about this? How about if in a year you haven't found another podcast to listen to and I haven't found another podcast to host? Maybe, just maybe, let's just meet somewhere, I don't know, in the middle of Brooklyn Bridge at midday with a white rose in each hand and I'll get down on one knee and open the little box in my hand and you'll say yes and I'll reach out and place the earphones in your milky white ears and the passing pedestrians will applaud and I'll hold you close and turn around and smilingly yell, "She said yes! She said she would rate and review us on iTunes!" And alongside me is the love to my actually, the knocked to my up, and the Harry to my Sally's public orgasm, Ben Vanderveld.
Are we streaming? I hadn't noticed.
I thought you were going to lead with it. I'll have what he's having, which is several Red Bulls before this recording.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here. I am going to say straight away, I feel like I'm flying blind. This is not my area of expertise. There's obviously the classics I love, but Cards on the Table, the first time I ever watched When Harry Met Sally was about 6 weeks ago, which as far as we're all concerned time-wise is basically 10,000 years ago.
The before times, Ben, please.
The before times, yes, BT.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and my wife were away on a wee little holiday in a cottage and we were looking for a Netflix movie to snuggle up to. And the story of a highly professional level OCD businesswoman and a wisecracking Jew, we looked at it and thought, no, there's nothing we can relate to in this story.
Perfect. How did you find it?
I just sort of like scrolled down until I got to US rom-coms on Netflix and
this podcast is over.
Fair. I really enjoyed it. I liked it more than Sylv did. Listen, we're both suckers for Billy Crystal, but he is my power animal.
Yeah, he very much is.
One of several power animals. I feel like when I access my power animal, it's like when you try and decide what player you're going to play as on Street Fighter 2. But he's one that sort of scrolls past every three for me.
But, do you have like a Pokemon ball full of different comedians you can call upon? Like, Billy Crystal, I choose you.
Not just comedians.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, so, you know, sometimes...
Shola Amiobi, you!
Shola when I'm dancing is what I look like.
Yeah, George Harrison, when you really want to knock someone out.
Sorry, firstly, Paul is my favourite Beatle, and secondly, George is the
You're
most
so mainstream, Ben. You're so mainstream.
Don't provoke me, because I will bore you to tears with the reasons why Paul is great. But we don't have to do that. Like, to be fair, my
or would be
Beatle...
if he hadn't died in 1966.
Stop it. Like, do you know what? I've decided, no, my favourite Beatle is George, and it is Sir George Martin. There you go. there is the hipster's choice. Anyway, it's time to introduce this week's guest. Our guest this week is a writer, performer, and improviser. And no, it's not just me and Barry talking to our reflections for an hour. She trained with the phenomenally named Fourth Monkey Theatre Company, who presumably do no evil via the medium of armpit farts, and has trained in Chicago-style long-form comedy improv with Monkey Toast and the Free Association. She's been a member of the Soho Theatre Writers Lab, where she developed her debut one-woman play, Algorithms, a bisexual Bridget Jones for the online generation, which was longlisted for Soho's Tony Craze Award, sold out its run at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and, according to her website, will be touring in the autumn. Fingers crossed we're all allowed out by then. She's just pulled a number of faces in response to that. She was a number of award-winning faces. She was recently named as one of the Guardian's 12 theatre stars for 2020, citing Algorithms as a show that was astonishingly assured and practically broadcast ready. By rights, it should have reached Fleabag-sized audiences by next summer, they say. Considering Phoebe Waller-Bridge is preparing to broadcast a live-streamed Fleabag into our homes, we hope our guest is limbering up to be the star of the next semi-apocalypse. It is the finest of Fifth Monkeys that is Sadie Clark.
Hello. Thank you. Well, very welcome. Hello, Sadie.
I wasn't sure whether to be like, it's not autumn anymore, it's next year.
Yeah.
Everything's changed. Ooh.
Will you be working on algorithms? It's quite sort of a, it taps into the sort of the zeitgeist in a lot of ways. Will you have to sort of react to what's happened in the intervening time?
You know, I don't know. I was talking to a friend about this the other day. I was like, will it even be current? So it's going to be touring in spring 2021 now. Hmm. And I'm working on a TV treatment. But yeah, it is strange because everything is so online in a different way now because of this pandemic. It sort of feels like, is my piece about online dating going to be that current after Love in a Time of Corona?
I do feel that being part of a list of theatre stars to watch in 2020 is a, it's, you kind of hope the Guardian will have the good grace of a lot of people to let that carry over and let you guys be the theatre stars to watch in 2021 as well.
I hope so. I mean, luckily my run of algorithms, which I did at Soho Theatre this year, still happened. So I just about snuck in there. Yeah. The theatre's closed 2 days after my show closed.
because they couldn't do any better.
Yeah, I've been quizzing some friends who were doing online Zoom dates and things about it, wondering like, oh God, what I'm going to have to include. I'm going to have to rewrite it for the lockdown, but it's okay. Mm. I'll probably just write another show.
Is that feels like it's taking Tinder to the next level. So is that what I think it is?
So I was chatting to a friend yesterday, and she'd heard from another of our mates that she'd been like doing some video chat dates. Now she'd just been doing them on like WhatsApp, which is, it feels a bit more normal, like a WhatsApp video call. But my friend had misunderstood, so she'd set up a Zoom to online virtually date this guy she'd been chatting to on Hinge, had sent him like the meeting ID and the password, and then of course it cut out at the 40-minute mark halfway through. Serious story that he was telling. I think she took it to the next level, but certainly there are,
she took it to the next level, which was the business account on Zoom.
Yeah.
So I think we've already discovered that, well, you're clearly extremely talented in the world of theatre and adaptable to all current circumstances, but what are you worst at in the world, Sadie?
I've actually got two, and my first one will probably explain why I've got two. I am worst at making decisions. I will debate for hours. I will cry over the simplest of things, like not being able to decide whether to go to Sainsbury's or Tesco's in the lockdown.
These are the big decisions you got to make, though, because you got to gamble on who in your surrounding area shops where, who will have overshopped, what will be left.
You've got to try. Who's going to have those green beans that I'm after?
Yeah, you need to be an actuary as much as anything else in the current climate.
I make lists and they don't really help. And I usually end up just ringing my mum and getting her to just decide for me.
Oh, wow. So your mum is your own personal magic eight ball.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to think it's because I'm a Gemini. I'm good at seeing both sides of things, but it just means I go round in circles because I'm like, well, if I do this, then this might happen. But if I do this, then this might happen. But then this might happen. And what if this happens?
Gemini bisexual is just too much of a coincidence to bear, by the way.
There's so many of us, though.
What is your second thing that you are terrible at because of your indecisiveness?
It's saying no, and that's normally around FOMO, fear of missing out. I'll say I've managed to like double book myself even in the lockdown. So a friend of mine had a Zoom birthday quiz, and at 10:30 I was like, guys, I have to go. I've got another online party to get to.
The great thing about all these like Zoom parties and things you can go to is you can much more easily carry out an Irish goodbye. You can very much just, you know, leave the conversation without warning anyone and just pretend your internet cut out when people ask you the next day where you disappeared to, which isn't an excuse you can use in real life.
The thing is, the worst thing is for attending Zoom parties is my internet is strongest in my kitchen. So I'd go to the party and I would immediately be in the kitchen. Should we introduced the fourth wheel to this podcast, and so upgrading it from a Reliant Robin to a Maserati.
Let's do it because
this week, ladies and gentlemen, it's another Patreon special episode where one of our $10 Patreons is activating their right to pop onto the show and wave their gavel of justice. It is a returning guest, a long, very long-term school friend, and world-beating authority on all things Japanese cartoons, Japanese noodles, and Japanese, Korean, and other music. Please welcome back the marvellous Danny Charlton.
I would like to point out that my gavel is a Robin mug full of wine.
It's extremely autumnal, Danny.
Yeah, I'm also like specifically on brand because I was late to the call. So the last time I was on the show, I said that I was like a day and a half late to actually record the program.
That's true.
And then now, because everyone says late, and I'm like, I don't think you have anything on me, really, genuinely. Yeah. So yeah, I was late to record again for the second time. So on brand throughout.
The advantage of, as soon as you entered the call, we all had to stand up, my lud, because Danny is judging today's episode. Having suggested the topic, she will be making the ultimate decision as we lay before her the evidence we have gathered. very happily, actually, I had asked Sadie if she wanted to come on the show around the same time Danny proposed the topic of world's worst rom-com. And it happened to be one of the topics Sadie asked, could she do? So,
yay!
Perfect.
I just want like film suggestions in these lockdown times.
Danny, I have plenty because I couldn't make a decision. So there's about 9 on my list.
Well, let's start off with the man who says he is in unfamiliar territory, Ben van der Velde. What have you found out for us?
So, first of all, I should say what I think are my favourite rom-coms, just to put my credentials out there. They are mostly pretty mainstream. I mean, I'm a big sucker for 99.5% of Four Weddings and a Funeral, and then I turn off before that last line. Groundhog Day is a rom-com, albeit that it is also all about the cycle of birth and rebirth in Buddhist theology. It absolutely is.
It's definitely not about a man engineering a woman's life to suit his.
There's also that it's weird because when I first watched Groundhog Day, it was very funny, and then I read an article about it being a very Buddhist film. I was like, oh, how wonderful! It's got this deeper philosophical element. And then most recently watching it, I was like, there's a 15-minute bit sliver about 2/3 of the way in. It's not quite gaslighting, but it's essentially using gaslighting as a romantic tool.
There's a lot of rom-coms that do that.
Yeah, it's very difficult. We're all going to be walking a very fine line to going, I mean, yes, this, but also it's so funny.
Yeah.
Sorry, men behaving questionably around women in a rom-com.
Almost all of them directed and written by men as well, funny enough.
Well, which is why when we chatted about it earlier, Harry Met Sally being written by a woman, and also I didn't realize it was written based on Nora Ephron interviewed the director Rob Reiner about his failed marriage and his dating and his relationship with women, and it's what makes it so intimate.
Yeah, they've said in interviews before that basically Billy Crystal is kind of playing Rob Reiner and Meg Ryan is kind of playing Nora Ephron's sides of their discussions and their arguments, which is really interesting. Yeah,
hell of a thing. And the only other two that I can think of that I love, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. completely outside of any of the romance, the scene where Steve Carell gets his chest rug waxed is astoundingly funny.
That's genuinely his hair.
Yeah, I know. And my sort of my guilty pleasure one, which I formed an unlikely bond with my brother-in-law over every Christmas, or almost every Christmas, is The Holiday.
Oh God!
It's in your top one.
No. That's it's a guilty pleasure. It cannot compete with all the others I've said, but Jude Law is obviously in real life a rotter, but there's something about him being that divorced dad that really hits me. Like Kate Winslet, who, you know, is, let's not make any bones about it, an absolute twat. But her burgeoning relationship with her old Jewish neighbour, is it Eli Wiesel, the actor who plays him?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I like to think if I were an elder statesman of comedy in my 80s or 90s and was feeling lonely, that a Kate Winslet-esque figure in that film would come and befriend me and welcome me out of my little Jew hutch.
What, like tempting you out with pieces of Haller?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Anyway, that's the good shit. Let's talk about some bad stuff. For reasons that I don't fully understand, one of the first ever, if not the first showings of Four Weddings and a Funeral, instigated a 30-person walkout in Salt Lake City in Utah. Oh. And obviously the famous first scene is Hugh Grant saying the word fuck over and over again.
Right.
And the devout Mormon congregation watching stood up and walked out.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they were all annoyed that the four weddings weren't between the same man and four different women.
That is world class. World class stuff.
You're welcome.
I looked up a film called A Tall Story, which was Jane Fonda's film debut in 1960.
Wow.
The person, it's also Robert Redford's first film. He plays an uncredited basketball player. Sorry.
That's amazing.
A basketball player in an uncredited role, not a basketball player who, you know, scores loads of hoops and never gets any of the credit for it. And brilliantly, the director of it, the film before was a multiple Academy Award winner called Sayonara, and the film after it was South Pacific.
Wow.
This is a strange movie about sort of the sexual politics in the early 60s, and it was meant to showcase Warren Beatty and Jane Fonda. But Warner Brothers refused to approve Warren Beatty because at that time he lacked name recognition. And they wanted to use an established actor. So Joshua Logan offered the role to Anthony Perkins. Now, that was...
That's such an odd pairing in my head, putting Jane Fonda and Andy Perkins together.
Well, the biggest problem on set was that Anthony Perkins was a closeted gay man at the time, so him and Fonda just couldn't get any chemistry together, not helped by the fact that he probably really fancied Joshua Logan, the director, as well. And Fonda has described it as being a Kafkaesque nightmare that brought out all of her insecurities as an actress and made her question her own identity, physical appearance, and career. There was an infamous shower scene in it between her and Perkins where she had to sort of, well, be naked, or at least be naked on set, and nuzzle and caress him, and they practiced it loads, and it just made her feel awful, as I'm sure intimate scenes can.
I just had the idea that in the middle of the scene, he went, can I just stab her instead? We're in a shower. It seems like, I feel like that's what a character would do.
My instinct is just...
Yeah.
The Time magazine review from it is absolutely, it pulls no punches. Nothing could possibly save the picture. Not even the painfully personable Perkins doing his famous awkward act, not even a second-generation Fonda with a smile like her father's and legs like a chorus girl.
Wow, where you identify her by her father's identity and her
and
legs.
Her legs.
Yeah.
Shout out to Roger Ebert's review of a film called A Place for Lovers, which is it doesn't have the com, but it's got the rom. It's a French-Italian romantic film. About a terminally ill American fashion designer in Venice and a race car driver who has a whirlwind affair with her. Roger Ebert called it the most god-awful piece of pseudo-romantic slop I've ever seen. And Charles Champlin in the LA Times referred to it as the worst movie I've seen all year and possibly since 1926.
Wow.
But the movie I am plopping for... I said plopping for and I meant plumping for. But...
I feel like plopping is very much the attitude to take with some of these.
It's a movie directed by James Mangold, which I know, I'm just saying his surname now, sounds like a bad made-up anti-Semitic slur.
It's like a Will Ferrell character.
Yes, it is. So one of his very early movies was Copland, a really gritty movie with Sylvester Stallone all about corrupt policemen. It's a brilliant film. Girl Interrupted, Walk the Line, 310 to Yuma, so, you know, Western, The Wolverine and Logan. The Wolverine Logan, important to bring up there because Hugh Jackman stars in the film I'm about to talk about. But this is a director with real credit to his name, real serious heavy films. But this movie is called Kate and Leopold.
Yes.
Oh. I know this one. Strong choice, Ben.
Thank you. And from the trailer, in 1876, Leopold, Duke of Albany, was a bachelor with few prospects. In 2001, Kate McKay had a successful career, but no life. But now, because what occurs is that this is a fantasy film that tells the story of a duke who travels through time from New York in 1876 to the present and falls in love with a woman in modern-day New York. Because her brother, played by Liev Schreiber, has somehow managed to create a time-travelling machine. My favourite bit of the trailer, after unfunny line after unfunny line, after fish out of time and out of water joke, after fish and out of time and out of water joke, is a bit where the voiceover says, Hugh Jackman and Meg Ryan in a story of a man and a woman. And then there's a pause forever that makes you think that that's it. It's just the story of a man and a woman. But no, it's a man and a woman who refuse to let a few centuries come between them. It looks so bad.
So you have a guy. What news from Prussia?
So he is based on one of Queen Victoria's lesser known children.
He's based on, inspired by the true story of.
I'm just going to read you the plot. Feel free to stick your respective oars in whenever you feel necessary. 28th of April 1876, Leopold is a stifled dreamer. He has created a design for a primitive elevator and has built a small model of the device. His strict uncle Millard has no patience for what he sees as his frivolous interest in the sciences and has brought him to New York City in order to marry a wealthy American heiress. When Millard chastises him for disrespecting the monarchy and the peerage as a whole, Leopold counters that his uncle's idea of nobility are outdated and true worth is found in those who pursue initiatives. So I think we can see where that arc is going.
Yeah.
While sketching the Brooklyn Bridge during its opening ceremony, Leopold notices Stuart Besser taking photographs with an anachronistically small camera and laughing uncontrollably at John A. Roebling's repeated use of the word erection to describe the bridge. Stuart is an amateur physicist, in brackets, and the great-great-grandson of Leopold from 21st century New York, who has discovered the existence of gravitational time portals that allow time travel. Can you smell that freshly baked MacGuffin, ladies and gentlemen?
I'm pleased that it has some sort of basis in science, though, because on my list, which is one of the ones that's been rejected, it didn't make the top three, but is The Night, spelt K-N-I-G-H-T, Before Christmas, which is about a knight from Norwich, England, who time travels to Ohio.
Yes.
2019, for some inexplicable reason. It's just a medallion. There's no science, there's no physics, there's just a shiny medallion and an old crone, as he refers to her.
That could be what the C stands for in E equals MC squared.
Einstein and what you call her, Jennifer Garner, starred in 13 Going on 30, didn't they? No, actually, if there's a rom-com about Einstein, it has to be called We equals MC squared.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Let's write that.
I mean, Netflix will program literally any shit if we put Adam Sandler in it.
Adam Sandler is Einstein.
Albie Einstein.
Albie Einstein.
My taste is bad, but I still wouldn't watch that.
Yeah. Oh, okay, fine. That's a hard no then.
Yeah.
I think the problem is the casting. Adam Sandler is an immediate turn off for 95% of women.
Yeah. Yet he doesn't seem to realise that.
Let's get back to the plot, because I'm about to get to a key plot point. Later, Leopold catches Stuart in the Duke's study, photographing his schematic diagrams. When Stuart attempts to flee, Leopold follows and tries to save him from falling off the unfinished Brooklyn Bridge, only to fall with him into the time portal.
Amazing.
Leopold awakens in 21st century New York. Stuart explains the portal they travelled to has disappeared, but Stuart has created the formula which forecasts when the next one will appear, and Leopold is tasked to wait it out in his flat for the next week. As Stuart takes his dog out, he is injured by falling into the empty elevator shaft and is eventually institutionalized for ranting about his scientific discovery. Leopold's unintentional time travel appears to have caused the disappearance of the elevator and may cause the disappearance of Stuart himself. Like,
wait, does he appear in a world where elevators just don't exist entirely?
Yeah, it's like yesterday, but for elevators. literally, the name Otis doesn't exist anywhere. So anyway, Leopold is intrigued by the cynical and ambitious Kate McKay, Stuart's ex-girlfriend who lives downstairs. She's very much a career woman. There's a line in the movie where her boss says to her, "You're a rarity amongst women, Kate. You're like a man." And it should be said, this is, like, I feel like any bad rom-com has to have Meg Ryan in it.
Meg is the undisputed queen of rom-coms, and I won't hear a bad word said against her. I mean, but apart from in all of the terrible films she's also been in.
Yes, and also, and I'm not going to judge another person's life choices, but the increasing amount of plastic surgery that she had done to her.
That's the patriarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at the patriarchy meeting for that, and I was one of the dissenting voices, but I got voted down by 10 billion to one. Sorry, that suggests that there are 10 billion men on this planet.
Shh, don't tell them. That's how we're in charge.
There's actually three times as many men as the people think there are.
I love the idea that there being like a patriarchy meeting. And so, like, what are we discussing today? Ding, ding.
It's mainly boobs and cars. That's why I don't really go anymore.
Yeah.
Essentially, they're all meetings that could have been emails.
Leopold starts to get to know this very busy businesswoman. Meg Ryan's brother is an aspiring actor who believes that Leopold acting so weird when he's overwhelmed to see that the Brooklyn Bridge is still standing. He believes that he's just an actor who is sticking steadfastly to his character. As the day passes, Leopold begins to fall in love with Meg Ryan's character, organises a dinner on the rooftop followed by a dance. How has he got the ability to organise dinner on the rooftop when he doesn't have a credit card, he doesn't have a bank account, he doesn't know how phones work?
Posh people just have a way. They walk into it and go, dinner, rooftop, now, and the staff of a restaurant immediately decant from the restaurant to a rooftop. I think they just, you know, he just has the air of authority about him.
The next day, Leopold agrees to act in a diet margarine commercial for one of Kate's clients, but walks off the set after finding the product disgusting. Realising that their time together is nearly over, both spend the evening in subdued contemplation. Stuart returns to his apartment, having escaped from the mental institution, and sends Leopold back to his own time. Stuart and Charlie notice Kate in the photos Stuart took at Leopold's ball and realise that her destiny must be to go back and be with Leopold. That night, whilst Kate is accepting her promotion at a company banquet, they race to meet her and show her the pictures. Kate abruptly ends her speech and the three of them rush to the Brooklyn Bridge. Kate makes it through the portal before it closes and reappears in 1876, where Leopold is now resigned to his marriage of convenience. Just before Leopold announces his bride, Kate enters the ballroom and he announces her name instead. Among the shocked guests, Kate and Leopold reunite with a kiss and dance a bridal waltz. Thus, Kate turns out to be Stuart, her fucking brother's great-great-grandmother.
Right?
Horrible.
Morally repugnant, scientifically questionable, and historically deeply inaccurate. Leopold and Stuart see each other at a speech at the Brooklyn Bridge, but the speech actually took place. The famous engineer died in 1869, 7 years before their meeting, and the bridge didn't open until 1883. So historically, awful. Leopold refers to Jack the Ripper, but the murders take place several years after the film takes place.
This movie features time travel. You can't really get annoyed about, like, certain tiny little historical accuracies that literally no one really gives a shit about.
If the writers are using time travel as an excuse, then what they're suggesting is that by Leopold falling forward in time, it has completely changed all of the various timelines, and so he is now aware of things that haven't happened in his own personal timeline. I know that it's a fool's errand getting stuck in the problems of time travel plotting, but this is unacceptable in every way. It is morally unacceptable, it is dramatically unacceptable, it's romantically unacceptable, and the fact that it's such a weird bum note from the director as well.
Yeah.
It's baffling, and that is why Kate and Leopold are my choice for the world's worst rom-com.
I need to know a couple of things before we move on. Number one, is Hugh Jackman dreamy?
He's always dreamy. He's Wolverine, yes please, and twice on Sundays. But,
but no hands, no hands.
No hands. Well, you say no, well, here's a question. When Wolverine ejaculates... Does adamantium come out of his penis?
But I'm going to go with probably not.
I'll say two things. A, Sadie looks suitably disgusted. And B, listeners, we know the nerds that you are. We want your take on this. How physically dangerous is it to have sex with Wolverine? Also, the hardest thing with Wolverine ejaculating that way is he must self-circumcise every time he ejaculates. Because by the nature of his mutation, it grows back every time.
So if Wolverine gets a cold, his bogeys aren't going to be made of knives. It's just like bodily fluids. He does not like his mouth is internally slicing itself open every time he takes a swallow of spit.
Yeah, I think the point is the adamantium is part of his skeleton. Unless a Wolverine, but a Wolverine presumably has a penis bone, like most mammals do. So does he have an adamantium bone? In his penis. This is the important. This is the read. I'm sorry, Sadie. We're gonna have to wait.
I'm so lost. I'm like, what is? Well, what? I've not even seen it. I'm sorry.
I think I'm done with Kate and Leopold. Unless we want to continue the Wolverine penis discussion. The Wolverine penis discussion. Also, an art house film that won the award at Cannes in 2017.
As you know, I have a list of 9 in total. Yeah. To narrow it down, I've decided to discount any that are a crossover between Christmas films and rom-coms, thus discounting A Christmas Prince, The Night Before Christmas, and Love Actually.
Yes, there it is.
Good. Thank you. Fuck Love Actually. Fuck it. And it's awful, saccharine, tedious, badly put together.
Except right, every scene that Emma Thompson is in, because she's amazing.
It's another reason I hate it, because they wrote in, you know, Alan Rickman doing that to Emma.
But I think it's like the anti Four Weddings and a Funeral there. Ben would watch none of that film, bar the 0.5% that Emma Thompson is in, crying, listening to Joni Mitchell.
I actually think is one of the best scenes ever.
Apparently she came in 12 times and every time broke down doing that, like as they were filming it, just like got to the same place every single time. My other favourite or least favourite fact about that film is Richard Curtis in an interview said there were more storylines. They had 4 or 5 others that were cut out of the film.
But they left the one in where there was like the completely no reason, just people who are stand-ins for porn actors, for just,
yeah,
they just didn't do anything, they were just there.
And they left in the one where he goes to America and sleeps in a bed with 3 American women and comes back with them all. No, yeah. No, Richard.
I mean, yeah. that makes me really worry about the caliber of those other stories.
I don't know, but it was the new Labour government. Wasn't there some sort of law that insisted that Martin Freeman and Chris Marshall just had to be in literally everything?
Yeah,
I feel like that was a symptom of the times.
So no Love Actually. And then I decided to discount any that I had decided were the worst because of gaslighting, because I realized that is most rom-coms. So that got rid of a few, including You've Got Mail.
Yes,
then we're left with 4.
Just misses on the podium.
I think 2 weeks notice isn't going to make it on, purely because it's just generally pretty dry. Like, the premise is ridiculous. If you've not seen it, it's Sandra Bullock, classic, another classic rom-com actress. She works for Hugh Grant, another classic. English bumbling, although he's not very bumbling in this. He's meant to be a bit more of a player in this one. He's still quite bumbling, isn't he? And he can't make decisions. Incidentally, he has to ring her to make every single decision for him. And after a year of this, she's his lawyer. After a year of this, she decides to give him her 2 weeks' notice. And then they sort of go off to this ball. And then there's a new love interest introduced very late on. And it's just all very boring. And then they end up together. But it's not really... You know, there's no meat there for me.
It's like painting by numbers, make your own rom-com there, isn't it?
Yeah. Moving on to the podium. It's another Sandra Bullock film that makes it into the top three, where she's also told, so she's a crossword writer. She writes one crossword a week for her local newspaper. That's her job.
What?
She gets heckled in her primary school in the start of the film by some primary school children who say, "How do you earn enough money to survive in writing one crossword a week? I bet you've got no boyfriend or no husband." And then her boss asks her if she thinks she works too much and if maybe she should go and have some fun out with some friends or on a date. And then she's like, "Actually, I've got a date this evening. It's a blind date that my parents have set up with this guy, I think because they think he's gay and they want me to test sexuality."
how
and then the film begins.
please tell me that she doesn't, that she writes like the simple crossword as well. It's not even a cryptic. Her job is to come up with, over the course of 7 days, 4 crossword clues a day.
And she tries to pitch in the start that maybe they could write a crossword a day, and her boss is like, "No, I'm not the New York Times."
Who do you think could you see in the role of the crossword compiler? I'm thinking Sandra Bullock or Jennifer Aniston.
The thing is with Hollywood as well is there's so often so many like syncretic films that come out where it's like Bugs Life and Ants came out at exactly the same time. So I'd love it if there was another movie where, oh God, I don't know, Meg Ryan plays a Sudoku compiler.
It's called All About Steve. You can rent it for
free. Oh, this is notoriously bad.
Yes.
Didn't she win like 5 Razzies for this or something?
Well, like some of the stuff I was reading was suggesting that there was a cover up because it's got Bradley Cooper in it as well. So someone was like, "Oh, there's been a cover up to hide the fact that All About Steve exists," when Bradley Cooper and Sandra Bullock were kind of going on their Oscars chase.
Yeah, because it was the same year that I think that she won for The Blind Side.
I think that's the year that she
made this movie.
Oh, what? She got the double.
Yeah, so she was like, she made this terrible piece of shit. And then she also got an Oscar for The Blind Side or something.
She won Worst Actress for All About Steve and the following day won Best Actress at the Academy Awards for The Blind Side.
Actually amazing.
Yeah. It also won Worst Screen Couple, I think, for her and Bradley Cooper.
Wow.
I mean, well, I'm going to proceed and I'll end up giving spoilers. Is that allowed?
Oh, of course feel it is. Free.
I mean, this movie's what, like 10 years old now?
Yeah.
11, yeah. So she goes on this blind date that her parents have organised with some family friends. She's not really up for it. She comes downstairs. She's got these amazing red boots that people keep dissing, okay? They're like these PVC. They're kinky boots. They are essentially kinky boots. And she keeps getting grief for them. Ugh. She comes downstairs. She sees Bradley Cooper, a.k.a. Steve. She knows that he's very active, runs back up to her room, puts on a mini skirt, gets her tits out, puts on some lip gloss, and comes back down the stairs. They get into his car. Before they've even driven anywhere, she pounces on him, straddles him, and they proceed to kind of get down to it.
Too
down to it. And then she asks him if he likes crosswords.
I mean, I appreciate the fact that she's so forthright. She's gotten the snogging out of the way and then also getting to make sure that he is down with her career.
Yeah, exactly. Two birds with one stone. And he does like crosswords, so she gets very excited. Well, he's like, "They're all right." She gets really excited, starts just like spewing about crosswords. He decides, "This woman is not for me. I'm scared." He does the very typical receive a fake phone call. "Oh, yeah, you need me to be there? Yeah, I'm just on my way." And leaves her in the rain.
Oh.
Yeah. She then decides she's fallen in love with this man.
What, the guy who dumped her in the rain?
Yes. And so she submits her crossword for this week. And it is all about Steve.
I love this film.
So she gets fired for writing this crossword, which made me very angry. I was like, come on, you saw this crossword before it went to print. You approved it, and now you're firing her. No. You get a warning. You get a warning.
Yeah, at box socks at the editor's desk.
This is not how the publishing process works.
Exactly. I got very angry at that point. But she's fired. She's wondering what to do. Then she decides it's fate, because Steve is he's like a cameraman for a news channel. So he's on the road a lot. She looks up the most exciting current news, which happens to be that a horse that was filming a Western has dropped dead. And she goes to this set. But of course, she's like one step behind Steve. So she's like following all this news. So there's like the Western thing. Then the next thing is that this child has just been born that has a third leg. So she goes there. And here she does actually find Steve, and Steve's colleague convinces her that Steve's just scared of relationships. And so if he tells her to leave him alone, she shouldn't listen to him.
Oh, no.
There's this whole like wild goose chase following all of the news. She makes some friends. She convinces them to drive into this tornado after Steve.
Is this around the time that Jake Gyllenhaal film Nightcrawler came out as well, where he's chasing news? A really different take on that if he was being pursued by, you know, Drew Barrymore throughout it.
They hide from the tornado in like this sewage pipe and then find Steve. Steve's then like driving past in his news channel van. His mate throws a chicken bucket out of the window that says, "Come and join me at the mine. I love you, Steve." And so she then proceeds to this mine, which is where the next news events happened, which is that some deaf children have fallen into a mine shaft.
Oh, fucking hell.
It's honestly so bizarre.
Sadie, do you ever get, like, you're a writer, I'm a writer, do you ever get annoyed that some stuff gets commissioned and you don't?
Yeah, just a tiny bit. Yeah. Watching this, I was like, who pitched this shit? Yes.
And have you ever thought about letting deaf children fall in the mineshaft, though, either of you? Come on now.
Pulling on the old heartstrings.
Yeah, that's true.
You need something to fall down a mineshaft. Cat? No. They can land on their feet. Oh, what about children? Deaf children? Yes.
Yes.
The scene where it happens as well, it's almost like it's from a different movie. It's like this sort of like Sound of Music type thing with these. I thought that the film channel had changed when that scene opened, and there's like three teachers in sort of Sound of Music style frocks with baskets, and they're heading towards this fair with a merry-go-round. And then they sign to the children, and it's like subtitled like, "Yes, we're going to the fair. Are you excited?" And then the subtitles of the kids replying is like, "Yes," and they kind of like run off into the distance and just drop out of shot.
It's like the film is sort of like temporarily directed by David Lynch for 3 minutes.
But they're all okay. They get like crane lifted out. Sandra Bullock, she's called Mary, her character. Mary arrives and she sees Steve. He's there with his camera. And so she runs towards him.
No.
And she falls.
No.
The mine.
Yes!
And then we realise that there's also one child left who's been missed. And at this point, actually, I start to enjoy it quite a bit, because she uses her basic knowledge of physics, because she's quite intelligent. That's something that's kind of come up. She talks a lot, but she knows stuff. She uses her basic physics knowledge to construct a contraption out of some fairy lights that have magically come down the mine shaft. I'm not quite sure where from, perhaps from the fair. Builds this thing with an old mine cart and rocks, and it's to do with like the weight of the cart traveling down the mine is somehow going to lift them up. I don't really fully understand it, and I did make a note. I wonder if the physics of this are actually correct. But just as she's about to save herself, the news anchor, who's been a massive dick to her and like telling her, you know, ignore Steve, he does secretly love you, decides to jump in.
Being an anchor sinks like a stone immediately.
Yes. And the fireman's hose pipe comes with him. So now we've got this anchor man also stuck. So they have to work out how much he weighs, add in a bit more weight, some rocks to this mining cart.
Oh, no more maths.
And she's like, Sandra Bullock's like, okay, I'm going to hold you in this hand and I'm going to hold the kid in this hand and then we're going to go up. And News Anchorman asks, well, do you want me to hold you? Shall I do the holding? But then I'll get the credit for the idea. Oh, no, I don't want to take the credit. You do it. She's like, no, no, you do it. You take the credit. So annoyingly, after all that tiny bit where I'm like, yeah, she's going to save herself and like the physics of it. She knows she saves herself. No, everyone thinks that this douche anchorman that jumped in after her was the hero. And they emerged from the mineshaft, but it's Saving Grace, which I think is what made me question, is this the worst rom-com, is that actually Bradley Cooper kind of just explains on camera that actually, like, Mary's not a weirdo. Stop being mean about her. She's just an intelligent woman who likes to talk a lot. And they kind of have this, like, little nice reconciling moment where he's like, I'm sorry I lied to you and said, you know, I'd love you to come join me, but it's the work. I should have been honest that I didn't want to see you again. And she's like, it's okay, I've realized, like, it's important to just be myself. And then she goes off and like hugs the new friends she's made, and they don't have a romance. And that I really loved, because I thought it was going to be that he realized he loved her from this and that they kissed and that was how it ended. And if that had been the case, like, then it absolutely would have been the worst rom-com.
I kind of feel like they pitched all of those ideas and it got to the end and then they're like, and then they kiss. And that was the point at which the exec said, no, no, that's a bit too unbelievable. Yeah. The deaf kids in the mineshaft, absolutely fine.
The pony dying on the western. The her managing to chase him across the country. It's all fine.
Oh.
Oh my God, I just remembered my favourite line though that I meant to quote. So I told you about the red boots. Peepsy boots. So there's a point in the mine where she does a big speech, like kind of shouting up about how she just wants to be herself. She says that the reason she wears her red boots is because it makes her toes feel like it's 10 friends having a camping trip.
Oh,
that's cute.
That sounds cuddly.
Yeah, so All About Steve's up there, and then my two others, which I won't go into full detail on because I've talked enough, but I also had Blow Dry, which is mainly there for Josh Hartnett's terrible Yorkshire accent.
Oh, yes. And oh, my God.
Just another entirely bizarre rom-com, just full of, like, absolute jokes, plot points. It's about a hairdressing competition that happens in Keighley, which is a Yorkshire village very near to where my mum's from. And I just am hideously offended by Josh Hartnett's Yorkshire accent in it.
Do you think someone misread his name as Josh Hairnett and thought, presumably he'll be good at this?
I forgot that Josh Hartnett was a thing until this exact moment.
He was so sexy for about 12 months in the early noughties.
Oh, yeah. I had a big thing for him, and I think I kind of ignored the accent issue when I first watched Blow Dry when I was like 13. And top of the podium, I think, is probably How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Kate Hudson and Matthew McConaughey. I can never say his surname. McConaughey.
Matthew M.
It's pre reconnaissance, as someone pointed out.
This is very much the failure to launch era of McConaughey's filmmaking.
Yes, golden rom-com boy. So it's Kate Hudson and Matthew M. Kate Hudson's character is a journalist who wants to write about serious political things, but instead writes a how-to column. And because she wants to write serious political things, she decides for some reason to write an article called How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, based on the fact that her best friend keeps messing up in relationships by doing all of the typical things women do in relationships to make men dump them. I'm doing quotation marks for our listeners. And it's things like being too sensitive, being too clingy, coming up with like nicknames for his penis, things like that. Matthew's character works for a jewelry company in advertising, and in order to get the pitch for a client of theirs, he makes a bet that he can make a woman fall in love with him in 10 days. Chaos ensues when the two come together and pick each other as their respective people, kind of orchestrated by co-workers of Matthew's who kind of know that Kate Hudson's character is doing this How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days thing. So it's all about this like push and pull between him trying to make her fall in love with him and her trying to lose him. But it's just full of like the worst stereotypes about women and men in general, and just like very infuriating. And then it ends with her deciding to leave New York, go and interview for this like political journalism job in Washington, D.C. So like her dream. But he stops her, I think, on the Brooklyn Bridge, if I remember correctly, in her taxi. And tells her he loves her, and then sends the taxi like straight back to his apartment with all her belongings and kisses her on the bridge, and they're left without a taxi.
You're walking home now, guys. Absolute goons.
But yes, it contains a lot of the classic rom-com things, but in a very infuriating way, if I remember correctly.
All About Steve is nearly too interesting.
Yeah, that's what I
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days is just... It's all of the banal things you would imagine with no interesting quirk to it at all.
Exactly. But I thought I'd talk about All About Steve more just because it is so much fun.
Yeah, and, I think that's pretty fair. Mindy Kaling was interviewing Billy Crystal about working on When Harry Met Sally. And she said, it must be irritating to be in so many movies where iconic lines are constantly being said at you. Billy Crystal was actually like, oh, actually, you know what? I'm fine with that. He did go on to talk about how the famous orgasm scene came about. They were having a conversation pre-production with Nora Ephron. She brought up the fact that women fake orgasms. And Rob Reiner, the director, said, no. They never did that with me. And she said, I'm pretty sure they have. And basically had the scene. They basically had the conversation. Then Meg Ryan, in this conversation, said, this is hilarious. Wouldn't it be funny as a topper if I had faked an orgasm in a public place? And then Billy Crystal said, yeah, what a crowded restaurant, is a big, really loud, crazy orgasm. They all were laughing and building the scene together just over this conversation, which is really like exciting insight into the creation. As Billy Crystal says, flash forward to 4 or 5 months later, we're at the first screen testing in Pasadena. Rob Reiner and I are sitting at the back. No one knows we're there. The movie's playing really well. And the scene comes on. The audience is going berserk. And Rob and I know what's going to happen. And then there's one look at Estelle. That's Rob Reiner's mum, who plays the old woman. And so we set her up where she is geographically, and then it finishes. And then when she says, I'll have what she's having, Mindy, I've heard big laughs in my life in a movie theatre, and this was beyond anything I've ever heard before. And Rob and I held hands in the back and went, oh my God.
Oh, that's that amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. That's a beautiful tribute to how completely misguided men are in terms of how well they're doing in the bedroom.
Billy Crystal came up with the line, I'll have what she's having, and Rob Reiner decided they needed an older Jewish woman to play the customer. And he told his mother, you know, the scene is going to be very funny and the line you have is hopefully going to be the topper, but if it doesn't work, then we'll probably cut it. And then she says, oh, it's okay, I just like spending the day with you. So Rob Reiner's mum came and just to be on set with him, and she came down to Cat's Deli in New York, had a hot dog, and the rest was history.
I love that that's Rob Reiner's mother. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. In fact, in 2013, an improv group from New York called Improv Everywhere recreated the orgasm scene with two actors sat at the table in Cat's Deli, dressed as Harry and Sally, and there were 20 other couples all in on the act. The woman being Sally fakes her orgasm, and around the restaurant, 20 additional women all started joining in one by one as like a flash mob orgasm broke out, creating it. And it's really fun, like all of the patrons and the employees are losing their minds going, what's going on? And then at the end, one woman who was looking appalled throughout it all then stood up and said, I'll have what they're having. So it's
amazing. It is the I Am Spartacus of orgasm scenes.
Yeah,
it's that is the best like flash mob ever.
Very much.
And sorry, wettest. Instead of I Am Spartacus, someone should have started up at the end and said, I am clitoris.
Yeah, of course. Anyone's seen the worst flash mob ever if you were visiting it with your parents?
Yes, this is true. I can imagine there were probably some people who didn't enjoy it quite as much. Another Nora Ephron story. In Sleepless in Seattle, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, they don't really meet until the final scene. So you're having this love story where they're 3,000 miles apart, basically. They have Meg Ryan go in one door in Baltimore and Tom Hanks comes out of another door in Seattle. The way the film is cut, they actually used the same door. They shipped the same door from one city to the other to have this like synergy between the idea that they were in the same place, even though they're so far apart from each other.
I've not actually seen Sleepless in Seattle, and it's been on my list for ages. Because
I love Nora Ephron's great. She says, if someone says, how do you manage to be a true believer in romance after three marriages? And she says, if I weren't a romantic, why would I keep doing it? There's no one who's more romantic than a cynic.
Very true.
It's true. I'm extremely cynical, and 95% of my movie diet is just truly, truly questionable rom-coms.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I read about She's All That, another classic.
What was was she?
Well, you'll find out that she wasn't for in a second. The School, it's Freddie Prinze Jr. and Rachel Lee Cook are in it. The School in She's All That is the same school in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And Freddie Prinze Jr. is married to Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, yeah, he is, isn't he? Sarah Michelle Gellar. Yeah,
are they still
true.
Married?
They are still married, and they're my favourite celebrity couple. I love them.
Aww.
That's terrible. But Sarah Michelle Gellar is one of those, oh, no, she's Republican celebrities.
We're going to talk about Sarah Michelle before the end of the programme.
Yeah. Also, there's a scene in She's All That where Rachel Lee Cook and Freddie Prinze Jr. kiss, and Rachel Lee Cook said she didn't really like the take that they were doing, so she started blinking a lot, assuming they wouldn't use that part in the film. And they did.
Weirdly, if you've seen the film, that's kind of in character. So
yeah,
that nearly made it onto my list as well.
It's a very solid choice.
And I'm nearly at mine. I do like the story from the filming of Knocked Up. Couldn't go through this without mentioning another Judd Apatow film. The basic story of Knocked Up is there's a one-night stand between Allison, an entertainment reporter, and Ben, a directionless slob, leading to an unwanted pregnancy, and the couple decide to carry the baby to term. And it's sort of a mix between stoner comedy and rom-com. There's a scene in it where they show the lead character having her baby, and they show the baby crowning. And Judd Apatow said, the reason I wanted to show the crowning shot is if I don't, it looks like an episode of Friends, and I'm trying to make you feel the pain of that experience because it's the most intense moment in people's lives, and I had to do something that hadn't been done before. My original goal was to find a woman who would allow me to shoot the baby coming out and then match it into Katherine Heigl, the same sheets, the same bed. And we got close to getting it done. But here's why we weren't allowed to. The state of California says you can't do that because the unborn child would need a worker's permit. And I can't get it until he's born.
Yeah, like the baby needs a contract.
Yeah,
because he will be a starring role, and you can't contract him until he's born. God.
Could they not have got the baby to like do a handprint through his mother's belly?
But the baby couldn't give their consent anyway. The parent would have to give.
Well,
their consent.
Well, exactly.
But the parents couldn't consent until the baby existed, so they'd need to be there ready to sign as it was emerging.
Yeah,
which would ruin the shot.
Yes. If someone had to lean in with a clipboard to the child, it's like, quickly, quickly. But my choice for was rom-com, and this was an easy one for me because I still vividly remember the very first time I saw the trailer for this, is the film Leap Year, starring Amy Adams and Matthew Good.
It's a very solid choice.
Oh, I mean, as a rom-com in general, terrible, but when you're Irish having to watch this film, even worse.
Give me a recap because I have seen it, but I think a lot of the worst ones I've seen I've blocked.
Yes, well, Amy Adams follows her boyfriend, Adam Scott, of Parks and Rec fame, to Dublin to propose to him on the urging of John Lithgow.
Ah, yes.
John Lithgow, because apparently John Lithgow tells her about Bachelor Day, I think, which we've talked about when we talked about February 30th recently, Ben, mm-hmm. and leap years, because in Ireland, according to John Lithgow, a woman can propose to a man on February 29th. Mm. What a ridiculous idea, a woman proposing to a man. But charming Irishman Declan, played by Englishman Matthew Good, puts a spanner in the works.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. There are so many problems. Oh. No. Okay. So, just sit down for guys, because I've got a lot to get off my chest here.
Start at the beginning and just let loose.
She basically doesn't want him to propose to her before she proposed to him, and she can only do it on February 29th, apparently. So she decides to fly to Ireland to propose to him, but there's trouble on the plane. During the turbulence, she shouts out the words, "I'm not going to die without getting engaged."
Oh, because that's the priority.
Not married, just engaged. The storm diverts the plane to Wales. Now, I deviate to a review from Hot Press, the Dublin-based magazine, which says, this was at the start of the 2010s, so we're still in the aftermath of the 2008 crash and all the stuff that came after that. As if economic downturn and the Confederacy of dunces at the top weren't bad enough, Leap Year revives some horrors of old. Remember the Crap Ireland from movies of yesteryear? Well, Crap Ireland is back on screen, and crapper than ever. Anand Tucker's risible film offers the self-loathing Irish consumer a unique opportunity to experience a backward nation of drunken, superstitious morons. No infrastructure, and cutesy pie John Hind landscapes. The plot is standard rom-com issue. Amy Adams travels to Ireland to propose to her fiancé, but gets sidetracked by a rugged Irish barman, Englishman Matthew Good, as he's noted in most of the reviews, and subnormal natives, who actually use the phrase top of the morning. According to the film's geography, we now think Dingle is located near Swansea. Yeah, she flies to Wales, Swansea in the south of Wales, a mere hour and a half on the train to Fishguard, from where you could legitimately get a ferry to Dublin. But no, she decides to charter a boat to Ireland, to Cork, which is, you know, if anyone wants to look at a map of Ireland, look where Wales is in relation to Dublin and then to Cork. She got a crap enough boat that she had to get diverted to the tiny village of Dingle instead. And thus begins her 3-day journey to Dublin, which is, of course, but 3.5 to 4 hours drive away from Dingle. She says to a guy in a bar, "I need a taxi to Dublin." He stumbles forward saying, "I'm your man," misses, and drunkenly falls over. So we've ticked off the drunk Irish guy thing straight away. Matthew Good owns this bar, which is apparently not doing well, despite the fact it's just made a man drink enough that he can black out behind him. So he agrees to take €500 to drive her to Dublin. His accent, by the way, of course, is terrible. And his car is even worse. He's got a really clapped out car, which, because we all do, apparently. He's wearing Aaron's sweaters and flat caps. Nobody apparently knows what, you know, mobile phones are. He took the job, Matthew Good, apparently, because they'd let him fly back to London on weekends. Now, you might ask why she chose to drive to Dublin when maybe a train would be easy. But no, at a B&B, Anna is told that the trains aren't running because it's a Sunday.
Well, that's what I expect of a Catholic island in the 21st century.
She manages to shove Matthew Good's car into a stream. The car gets blocked by cows at one point, and because she's an idiot, she tries to move the cows. But he, being a crafty local, just sits down and lets them walk around, because that's the pace of life we live in Ireland. It goes without saying that she is an idiot, as most female characters apparently in a lot of rom-coms are. She's just the stupidest person in the world. She notes that she has to be in Dublin the next day. As I said, that it's a Sunday, she needs to be there on leap day for the Monday. The thing I like most about this film is it apparently is either it's either a period piece or set in the future, because there wasn't a Monday on February 29th in the years around when this movie was made. It was either in 1960, 1988 or 2016.
No, when the plane had to make its emergency stop in Swansea, it went through a time portal.
Yes. I think that's probably it.
She's from whenever it was the film is made, and she went back to like 1960s Ireland.
Because you can't have a good one without time travel. Which is why
everybody's so provincial.
Well, not only does she time travel, she also location travels, because she walks out of a pub in Dingle and apparently is on the Aran Islands, judging by the scenery. So clearly the location scouts were like, that's pretty, even though everyone from the country will go, that's not the same place.
Yeah, but nobody lives in Ireland. It's fine. We don't care about what you guys think.
But no, it's a remarkably small country, because they walk from Dingle to Tipperary in about an hour, which is a 2-hour drive. She blacks out an entire village by plugging in her BlackBerry, because the infrastructure is so terrible in the country. And my favourite thing is that OK Magazine wrote my favourite review of this. "There is one moment of hope in Leap Year, and it comes near the end of the movie, after the idiot lead character Anna faces a severe disappointment in a small Irish town, then hightails it to a jagged cliff. It's here that hope finally arises that Anna will come to her senses and live up to the title by taking a header off the cliff in an effort to atone for her sins of being the stupidest idiot alive, and leading the audience through 90 minutes of her drudgery-inducing hunt for someone, anyone, maybe even anything, to marry her." So Danny, you have laid before you exhibits A, B and C. Exhibit A, Ben presents to you Kate and Leopold, the story of a time-travelling Jackman and the bridges he loved. Sadie has How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, the handbook for all terrible, forgettable, passoverable rom-coms, and I offered you Leap Year, the very idea of a woman proposing to a man stretched out over about 2 hours of comedy, pyrite.
So before we get into my decision, which I've definitely already made, because for me, there is very much a clear winner. I would like to give you like an idea of the benchmark of which these are being assessed.
Okay.
And that is my best worst film, in the sense that I love it, but I know it is an absolute steaming turd of garbage. And that is a rom-com called Simply Irresistible, starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, a.k.a. Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
So it was made in like 1999. So she was definitely still Buffy at this point. Like, so this is like obviously like filmed between seasons. And she was obviously trying to break into like, you know, the main film sphere to have a post Buffy career, which that did not work out so well for her.
No.
She is a terrible cook running a restaurant, which she inherited from her dead mother. Thereabout, they have like four customers who are all only continue to go there because they were friends of her dead mother. She manages to find her inner culinary mojo, save her restaurant, fall in love with the help of a magical crab.
Oh, it came up on a list and I was like, that sounds so weird. It was talking about a CGI crab and I was like, no, I'm not even going to watch that.
As you might expect, we're in New York. And she gets sort of like duped into buying crabs for no good reason, despite the fact that she herself says, I don't know what to do with a crab because she's a terrible fucking cook.
Oh my God.
But of course, one of the crabs is magical. And so he crawls out of the bucket of crabs that she's buying. This is a gigantic bucket of crabs, I should point out, and they're all still alive. And he is like going through the crowds, pinches the ankle of another patron of the market, which is a guy whose name I can't remember because that's how important it was, who is the manager of a high-end department store in downtown New York, who is there with his chef because they're about to open a restaurant. And this is how they meet. This is the meet cute. She was chasing after it. Anyway, she grabs his leg because, of course, and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry, etc., etc., etc. And then they have like a really awkward conversation in which she somehow manages to drop in that she has a restaurant. So he then goes to her restaurant for lunch with his absolutely psychotic girlfriend. But you see, the thing about the magical crab is that it can then make her feelings transform the food she's creating. So because she was angry and annoyed while she was making some sort of like chicken thing for his like weird trashy girlfriend, it makes his girlfriend turn into a psychopath.
Oh my God.
They're having dinner and they break up, and obviously like, and this is kind of like the foundation for the whole thing. So because she puts her feelings into her food, she then sort of makes him fall in love with her like via pastry.
I mean, that bit I'm kind of on board with.
There's a scene where they are literally, and I am not even joking, floating on the ceiling because of like sex steam, like rising up out of a pot of custard. Anyway, so eventually, you know, the high-end chef who's opening the restaurant at the high-end department store thing, he quits because he's a Frenchman and he's angry about everything, and these are the wrong truffles or something like that. Anyway, what chef could he possibly hire to like be there on time for the opening of this extremely expensive million-pound restaurant, etc., etc., but this random woman who he met in a marketplace when she grabbed his leg chasing a magical crab? Because that's the thing that happens.
Oh my God.
And you know, there are people crying. It's extraordinary.
Can any of our three live down to that standard?
The answer is yes. Because Leap Year,
yes,
is so bad that I was only ever able to watch it once. I tried to watch it a second time and I was like, no, I just can't finish this. Because I watched
it.
You're not even Irish, Danny. That's what the extraordinary thing about Leap Year is that it's truly terrible to literally anyone watching it. It is, yeah. I mean, I love Amy Adams. I love her so much. I think she's wonderful. But honestly, the second time I tried to watch Leap Year, because I was just like, you know what? I love terrible rom-coms. I'm going to rewatch Leap Year. I couldn't get through it. And so that is why that is 100% my choice.
I fully concur, because I'd completely blocked it out of my memory. And it was only when Barry brought it up, I was like, shit, yes.
We're talking about 2 weeks' notice, which, for context, is the last DVD I ever bought. I was going to say.
What was it? A film so bad it stopped you buying DVDs?
No, well, no, that's not true, because that was quite recently. It's mostly because I don't have space anymore. Anyway, the reason why I bought it is because it wasn't at that time on any streaming services and I needed it in my collection.
Oh,
because it is truly awful. I love it. I just love it. It's just terrible. But yeah, no, Leap Year is has crossed the meridian of so bad it's good to just being so bad it's terrible again.
Yes.
And that's my choice. It's got to be Leap Year.
Perfect. Sadie, before we go, where can people find out more about you and hopefully get around to seeing you in person at some point?
They can follow me. I'm at Sadie Layla Clark on Twitter and I think Instagram. I think that's my Instagram handle as well. And my show Algorithms is at Algorithms Play. They can see a little clip of it online.
Yes, they can. Funny you should say that. Yes, if you visit the project that I've been running on YouTube, National E Theatre, that's theatre with the E from the end of it moved to the start of it, then you'll be able to see a 20-minute extract of Sadie doing a bit of Algorithms, which will hopefully give you a taste of what will come if you get to see the full thing. Yes,
come see the full thing next year when we're all out of lockdown and it's hopefully back on in London and certainly touring the UK.
Absolutely. And Danny, where can people find you if they want to find out more about you?
If you want to hear me talking between records, you can do so. I have a program on Amazing Radio, which broadcasts on Monday at 10 a.m. Or Saturday at 1 p.m. Or online whenever you really want to. So that's amazingradio.co.uk. You can find me on the Twitters, Danny_Charlton. That's Danny with one N because it's short for Danielle and that's how that's spelled. And anybody who doesn't spell it that way is wrong. You can follow me on Instagram if you want, but I only post pictures of my mum's dogs. So,
which, to be fair, is the content everyone needs these days.
Yeah, so that's just Danny Charlton on one word.
Meanwhile, we're all off to solve a word search while rescuing some lame orphans from a volcano. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.